They thus obviate the rigorous partitioning of family activities which permits some to consecrate themselves to intellectual pursuits while others, usually the wife and older daughter, are totally excluded. Union of souls. Let us first of all insist upon the importance of a personal life in this respect. The primordial duty of a creature can be summed up by this threefold rule: God must be known, loved and served first. Our union with God cannot therefore be subordinated to our conjugal love. This love is dependent upon the life of the soul and its union with God. Each partner ought therefore to reserve certain moments of quiet with God, moments of heart-to-heart prayer in which the other partner is not the first preoccupation. At this point, one partner has no need of the other to benefit by his prayer, for here the union of souls takes the full meaning of communion of saints. Our imperious vocation is above all that sanctity which bears the beautiful name of union with God, the sanctity of our souls first, then the sanctity of our marriage. We must desire not only union of God with our souls, but also union of God with our union itself, with the week consecrated on our wedding day and the family that is bomb of this love. Thus an indispensable personal life of the soul with God, far from excluding, fosters that common pooling which realizes the integral union of husband and wife and the union of their family with God. Their communion of soul is precisely what interiorly animates their life on all levels. It is the soul of their union. Husbands and wives must give God to each other, just as in the marriage ceremony they are mutually ministers of grace. Let them therefore know God together, ask His blessing on their home, adore together, ask pardon for their sins together, offer each other to God and offer their happiness and their suffering together. Must all spiritual initiative be shared thus? Should husband and wife have the same spiritual director, make a common mediation, examination of conscience and confession of faults? It is up to each couple to answer these questions as they see fit. They remain particular cases determined largely by the special vocation of each home. Suffice it to recall that there are sins of silence, silences which corrupt and kill love, and others which simply leave it in a state of mediocrity. On the level of union of souls, the immediate common work seems to be to make God known, to interest others, primarily our children, in the living God who enlightens every marriage. In conclusion, let us come back to earth by recalling the practicality of gradually realizing this complete union. If conjugal love, of itself, tends towards union, if it is a power of unity at work, then husbands and wives must collaborate actively with this unifying force. They should do it in the enthusiasm of a living hope and, in difficult moments, with the perseverance of true charity, and always in the faith that God Himself is at work in the heart of that love which is totally offered to Him. Could we but believe with conviction that since God wills our union, He will spare no pains to realize it. His sacrament utilizes everything with an ingenuity that is frequently surprising in order to make the union of husband and wife more sure and more total. In the last analysis, this essential collaboration towards conjugal union is for the glory of God. It is to give Him glory by what it is, by the masterpiece that is the perfection of love, by the image of God that is this week composed of two creatures who love each other, and by their love journey towards eternity. It is to give Him glory by what it accomplishes, the primary effect which is the child, the fruit of us, an image in its turn of divine fruitfulness, the soul of eternal praise which is as an instrument which we must tune and then offer to the Holy Spirit that He might draw from it a canticle of glory. Part 8, two in one flesh. The personality of woman, the man as father, life through love, the flesh and the spirit. Chapter IV. The personality of woman. Between two worlds. We can define the essential traits of woman's personality by comparing her with man. This comparison is not intended as another of the many more or less ingenious psychological parallels that have been published in recent years, but rather purports to show how the two personalities complete and call forth one another. Without going into cumbersome details, we can make the general statement that woman occupies two worlds, one above man, the other below him. From one point of view, she is closer to nature, from another, she is more sensitive to spiritual realities. In one sense, she is more carnal, in another, she is more mystical. When we speak of woman being closer to nature, we mean that by her functional role in passing on fife in the biological and cosmic sense of the word, she participates in the great rhythm of creation. Made for child. 67. Bearing, she is spontaneously in accord with all the mysteries of fruitfulness in nature. Humanity has always been more or less aware of this because the great religious rites and myths have traditionally associated the cult of woman with that of nature, with the earth, with Cybele. The mother goddess has always presided over the great life force, and through her, life has manifested itself under the sign of womanhood. Woman depends on her body and her body depends on the universe. Her sex pervades her entire organism, and through her sex the rhythm of the seasons, the days and the months are inscribed in her body. The maternal instinct, however spiritualized it becomes, always remains profoundly marked by the unconscious memory of the uterine life of the child. Indeed, the whole woman, her instincts and her manner of acting, bears this mark of an alliance with life, with the great forces in nature. This effective participation in the cosmos is something quite foreign to man. For him, the universe is an object of science and action. It is something to be studied and conquered. Man's relation to nature is more an intellectual one and demands a certain objectivity and thence a certain exteriority in relation to the object. A mystical identification with the world and an effective participation in the forces of nature are, from the masculine point of view, a poor means of understanding and dominating it. The other pole of woman's personality is mystical. By that we mean she is more spontaneously attentive and sensitive to values that cannot be measured in immediate results. She perceives in the world and in herself undercurrents, presences, symbols and voices. What man attains to only through his imagination or by virtue of prolonged and laborious research, she senses instinctively. And the most generous and disinterested virtues of woman, love, goodness, pity, solicitude, protection, are generally her response to these invisible signs which she feels are addressed to her personally. At the extreme point of this mystical vocation of woman, we find her specific religious role. Quicker than man, woman interprets the will of God. Quicker than he, she responds to it with her whole being. Being both carnal and mystical, woman's nature would seem to suffer a dichotomy. But we must not imagine a greater distance between these two poles than actually exists. Better adapted to the living rhythm of things, woman is better able to see in them their inherent spirituality, the presence of the invisible in the visible. When she watches a person, for example, she is more attentive than man to details of expression and the subtle contrasts and undertones of moods. At the same time, she is equipped to interpret these manifestations of personality in their deepest spiritual sense. This type of intuition, to which are joined woman's physical gifts and spiritual insight, is evidence that the two poles of her personality are but two aspects of one and the same reality. The double gift which she enjoys explains both why woman often irritates man and why he needs her. There is in man a natural distrust of any kind of knowledge or action that lies outside the domain of logic and reason, both of that knowledge which is below reason such as the sense and instinct and that which is above reason such as intuition and revelation. He fears both too little light and too much light. He rejects any power that would demand his consent before he has reflected and decided for himself. By nature, man is rational even when he is capable of immediate sensation. Woman is instinct and intuition even when she is capable of formulating logical judgments. This distinction is not absolute, but it is valid and explains the conflicts that arise between man and woman. It also explains their reciprocal need for each other. By her tendency to the concrete, the individual, the existential, the here and now, woman can exert a curative influence over man's algebraic intellectualism, which is often a mockery of reality. By her instinctive recognition of gratuitous and disinterested values, she can steer him away from the masculine superstition of efficiency. Allen, in his turn, with the balancing effect of the power of clear reasoning and ordered action, can protect her from the danger of useless daydreaming and erratic impulses. Another way of putting this truth is to say that man is more of time and woman more of eternity. Man's energy is expended in the concrete order of history and progress whose artisan he is. Woman is more interested in the unchanging spiritual values that underlie all temporal values. Whence the impression woman often gives of stagnation and immobility, whence also her character of refuge, of a harbor of peace. Man comes to rest in her, to find himself again and take new strength after his conquests or before his new departures. The old myth of Anterus, son of the earth, illustrates this well. So does that of Penelope. While Ulysses is adventuring abroad, Penelope awaits and prepares his return. She follows him in thought and in spirit, and even appears to him in a dream, for wherever she establishes herself, in the center of all, she is his refuge of peace. It should be noted that these different and complementary aspects of man and woman, which are admirably realized in marriage, are not realized only in marriage. They exist wherever men and women meet and collaborate, in work and friendship as in love. Nor are these qualities exclusively masculine or feminine, some of each are to be found in both. The most virile of men has in his character some feminine elements, although they are often smothered and atrophied beyond recognition. It is through contact with woman that he will become conscious of them and fructify them. Thus woman, who gives to man a new vision of the world, also gives him a better understanding of himself. The wife mother. Woman then stands at the frontiers of two worlds or two lives, the world of biological and cosmic life and the world of mystical and spiritual life. But these two worlds do not become clearly distinguishable until woman is called in the most personal sense of that word, to give herself. The primordial quality of woman's personality is that she is made to give herself. This is also true of man. Like woman, he too must give himself in order to possess himself. One of the fundamental accomplishments of modern philosophy is to have shown the interaction necessary to the possession of self and the gift of self. One cannot give what one does not have, as the old adage has it. The reverse is also true: we cannot really possess what we have until we have given it. But between the self-giving of man and woman there is a profound difference. Men can give himself to an idea, to a cause, to a collectivity, spontaneously. Woman can give herself only to a person. Insofar as she is open to the call of a living voice, to the distress of an individual, she is firmly indifferent to the abstract and collective. This carries over into the spiritual order. Man's vocation before God is above all a mission of fulfilling, of completing the work of the redemption. Woman experiences primarily a personal relationship with God. She too is called to perfect the kingdom of God on earth. But her attention is centered more on God than on the kingdom. She accomplishes her work more through personal love. This individuality of woman's gift is the salient trait of her love. More precisely, her gift is love. A young girl can meet a man, even many men, and display her charms without engaging any essential part of herself. But as soon as she hears a voice saying to her, "I need you," then she gives herself entirely. In this precise moment she becomes conscious of the worlds she carries within her and offers them to this mendicant. Then she becomes a wife. Throughout her life, her love will keep this personal note. It will always be directed towards an individual. There is here a risk that she ensnare her husband in a closed circle. But this risk is not inevitable, since a woman who marries a man, marries the whole man with his mission of fulfillment and the work he has to do. We often see the metamorphosis of a woman who before marriage limits her ideals to the family, to the narrow world of her relatives and her dreams.